Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with the stars and creators of the hottest shows on Broadway, off Broadway, and beyond. I'm your host, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to the writer Cui Nguyen. Off-Broadway audiences will know him for plays including Viet Gone, seen at Manhattan Theater Club in 2016, and his upcoming production there, Poor Yellow Rednecks. But longtime New York theatergoers will know that his roots lie farther downtown with his award-winning Vampire Cowboys Theater Company, the creator of gleefully genre-bending, geek-friendly theater like She Kills Monsters, Fight Girl Battle World, Alice in Slasherland, and The Inexplicable Redemption of Agent G. The troupe has been mixing theater with geek culture long before Game of Thrones conquered HBO, Marvel reigned at the box office, or Harry Potter and the Cursed Child brought fantasy to Broadway. In news that might make the company's fans feel old, Vampire Cowboys marks its 20th anniversary this year, and to celebrate, the troupe is back with its latest production of a new play by Nguyen, Revenge Song, which started performances February 4th at the Geffen Playhouse in L.A. Nguyen is in L.A. working on the show, but he's calling into the studio to talk with me about stage fights, Comic-Con, and stealth diversity.
Hey, Cui. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, how you doing, man?
So Vampire Cowboys is 20 years old. How did that happen?
Purely by accident. Like, to be quite honest, like, I had no idea that we were around this long until at some point Robert was like, hey, 2020, we started 2000.
And Robert is, for people who don't know, so...
he's the director of all my plays. He's right. The co-artist director of Vampire Cowboys, yeah.
Right. And was that... was that realization part of what prompted the show you've got going on now?
Oh, no. It kind of came about, to be quite honest, and if any of the other theaters that have commissioned me are listening, they'll probably get mad. But basically, I had a string of commissions from all these different theaters, and the Geffen was like, Matt, and he was like, What is the thing that you're most passionate about? What is the thing that you really, really want to do next? And at that point, I had done a show with Vampire Cowboys in like 3 or 4 years. It wasn't that long, but it was longer than usual, considering we used to do a show per year every year.
Yeah, right.
And I was just like, man, I would just like to be with my company again. I want to be with the artists that I've climbed the mountain with, the guys that have shaped me as an artist. Those are the people I want to work with. He's like, well, let's make it happen. Right. And of course, like, as soon as you do that, instead of having like just one or two people from a theater going checking in, going, "Oh, how's that commission going? How's that play going?" I have an entire company, a director, and my wife, who's a producer, just all on me, going, "Hey, are you gonna make the thing in which we get to all hang out and make a show and party again?" And I'm like, I guess I have to write it. Yeah. So that's kind of what prompted me and pushed me. It was massive peer pressure.
Yeah. And for people who aren't familiar with Vampire Cowboy shows, that explain the aesthetic and sort of characterize the kind of theater you're making.
It's on the surface, it's just like a big theater smorgasbord. Mm. We do, you know, stage combat and puppetry and multimedia and all sorts of tricks. We're extremely anachronistic and incongruent purposely.
Right.
But the heartbeat of it all is, for me, when I started the company, was to create superheroes for people who don't get to see themselves depicted that way regularly on screen or on stage. And so, you know, like 20 years ago, we kind of hid the fact that we were a company of diversity. we were like, oh, we're not going to push that, because I think as soon as
yeah, because
we
why
knew what? that Yeah, well, as soon as we pushed it, I think we were afraid that people would think we were medicine. You know, and no one wants medicine, right? They're like, oh, they're trying to, you know, create, you know, things that feel, I don't know, all the baggage that people get when they think of theaters that's mission is that. And so for us, I was like, well, then we'll make superheroes. That's going to be the heartbeat of what we'll do. And they just won't know that all our superheroes are LGBTQIA, POC, and right. female. They just won't know that. That'll just be part of the mixture. But that was it. We were just making action adventure shows that kind of challenged what you kind of thought a superhero should look like.
Right. And what is the craziest thing that you had to figure out how to stage for this show that you're doing right now? Because I feel like in all your shows you're doing, there's always at least one sequence or multiple sequences where you have to slay a dragon or whatever, right?
We definitely decided that we were going to use the Marvel model of making this play happen, a la going, oh, in every MCU movie, you have like basically the last 20 minutes is just a fight. It's a 20-minute giant action sequence. And the advantage in film is you have camera angles and music swelling, and when things are exploding, strangely, when people talk, you can still hear them. Stage, you know, in theater, you don't get the same flexibility. So you have to find different ways to do that. But it was definitely like, oh, how do we kind of create that same feel? How do we make that giant theatrical swell? So the challenge was for the last 20 minutes, right, to like let the dialogue drop out and allow it to be a big MCU ending. You know?
Right. And is there, I know there are puppets involved in the production, but how did you achieve that last 20 minutes that you're talking about? What were those?
It's basically three giant sequences. Mm. So the first sequence is a live feed where we're putting a camera on stage, and there's like basically a screen on top of the stage where you get to see what's in the lens. And that's what you're supposed to see, what's inside the lens. But on stage, we're using a lot of puppetry and miniatures and basically moving cardboard pieces to create shots that are like big action sequences of a woman basically fighting things and sneaking into a big, maximum security type of building. It's really fun. Because, it's like things like you can turn the camera sideways and she can like climb up the wall, like on the ground. It looks like she's climbing up a wall.
Right. Yeah,
it's like that. Yeah. So we're doing those tricks. And then that slides into what I call like the big traditional fight. Like it's a big, we have like this incredible, one of our actors is an incredible like acrobat fighter. And so we kind of like center a huge, like what we can, our Darth Vader fight there. And then we have like, once we get done with that giant fight movement, then we move into like a giant theatrical fight movement where I'm doing a big trick there.
Right. So we haven't talked yet about what the show's about. I've read it, but obviously haven't had a chance to see it yet because it's not up yet. So tell us about what it's about and what inspired it.
It's about a real life person named Julie Daubonnet. She was a 17th century queer sword fighter duelist / opera singer.
How did you find out about her?
Vampire Cowboys, for the longest time, I refused to do anything based on anything.
Is this the first time Vampire Cowboys is doing something based on something?
To have material based on something other than just stuff coming out of my head. And usually, basically, when we were just a company that did a show every year, we would, as soon as the show closed in the spring, I would then like send out the social media to our fans, like, what should we do next? And they would tell us like, oh, you should make a sci-fi show, or we should make a kung fu show or whatever. And that would be kind of like whatever was the biggest swell would be the next thing. And the one thing that kept popping up in my feed from like people who followed our company was Julie Daubonnet. It was the constant, like, you should do a show about her. You should do a show about her. You should do a show about her. Cause she's a big kind of, you know, we have a lot of queer fans and we have a lot of fight nerd fans, and it was kind of like the perfect, like, you know, Venn diagram moment of like, these are two things that this is one thing that both corners really like, but I was very much like, I don't tell other people's stories. And then I did a play called Vit Gone, which was about my mom and dad.
Right.
And so I told someone else's story. I told my parents' story. And I employed all my vampire cowboy techniques on it, and it's done very well. Right. And I then thought, well, if I'm going to do that with my parents' story, what would happen if I did it with a story that wasn't someone I was related to? Mm. Could it be equally successful? And so when Matt brought up the idea of commissioning me for the Geffen, I was like, oh, this seems like the right, you know, the prime time to do that, the time to try to push what I do as an artist. And so I was like, oh, it's time to do this, a play about this person that has been in my face for, you know, for 20 years apparently. And so I read up on her, and I was like, holy crap, she has a very interesting life. Like, the when people see the show, I think the craziest shit that's on that stage is going to be the things they assume are the stuff we made up, when that is not what we made up. Like, all we did was make superhero fights, and we made her speak like someone from 2020. Right. But basically the story of her, you know, falling in love and, you know, grave robbing and burning down churches and beating up, you know, opera singers and running away from the law and stuff like that. That was all her. And what I find interesting about her is, unlike, you know, most people you read about from that era, there's no real, in all honesty, there's nothing really important about her, you know, on the surface. She's not a noble or royal. She wasn't in the politics. She wasn't part of a war. The only reason why we know about her is because she broke a lot of rules. You know, she broke what expectations of what people expected from a woman at that time. And that's what I found fascinating about her. She was special because she was a rule breaker. And that felt very – that was something that I felt a kindred spirit to. My company felt a kindred spirit to. And it was definitely immediately like, oh, this is a story we have to tell.
Do you have a sense of why in particular the story resonates right now, as opposed to if you'd done this 10 years ago? Like, what do you feel like her story is really speaking to right now for us?
I really rarely consider that type of stuff, like how the stories I'm telling matter in the moment, because I guess I'm like a lot of writers who go, oh, hopefully it's a timeless story. Right. But I mean, it is a story about identity. It's about gender politics. It's about, you know, about the difference between like gender queer, like, you know, gender identity versus sexual identity, things like that, I think are obviously part of the conversation right now. But I mean, ultimately, it's just a fun story about, hopefully, as we depict it correctly, a story that adds yet another queer superhero to the world, you know?
Yeah. You mentioned Viet Cong, and you've got what is what I understand to be the second play in that trilogy, right? Also based on your sort of family history, Poor Yellow Rednecks, up.
That's at MTC this the May.
Exactly. When Viet Cong first came out, and people like me who had sort of known all your vampire cowboy work, it seemed a little more reserved and a little more uptown off Broadway as opposed to downtown. Were people worried that you'd turned respectable?
I was afraid I turned respectable. Anything. The funny thing is I always refer to Viet Cong as Vampire Cowboy Light. It's like, oh, it's like the starter hors d'oeuvre to really who I am as an artist. Because it's like, it's all the stuff that I do, but it's, you know, it doesn't, it's definitely pulled back. Right. Whereas Julia's full-on Vampire Cowboys, which I'm having a lot of fun seeing and watching people put together. But for that story, it was really like, you know, like when I wrote it, I actually wrote it for Vampire Cowboys, like, because South Coast Rep commissioned it, and it was a story that I had always wanted to tell, a story about my parents, and I always thought that I would have to grow super old and, you know, become like a totally different writer to be able to write. I'm like, when I become a respectable writer, then I'll write it and I will understand how to tell this story properly. And as my parents got older and I had kids, I very much sat down and was like, I'm just the writer I am, so let me just write this the way I know how to write it, so thusly no one will want to produce it except for my and so that's what I'll do. I'll just write a play for my company using the money that, and I was actually surprised that they wanted to do it. after, you know, it was done. Because it's still, though I think it's Vampire Cowboy Light, it still seems to be, because of the language and the way it's done, often the thing that's a sore thumb out of most people's programs, you know, actual theater program. I don't necessarily fit all the other shows in most seasons.
I'll have more with Qui right after the break.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
Now here's more from Vampire Cowboys, Qui Gwyn.
You mentioned earlier you were talking about the fans that you would talk to help sort of guide where the company went next. When did you start to accumulate those fans, and how did you then go about kind of nourishing them and kind of keeping that fan, fan base?
Definitely from solely for, I always credit my wife at that time, was just my producer and my girlfriend at that time, yeah. Like of Vampire Cowboys, Abby Marcus, because when we started, Robert and myself, we found her by accident because we produced our very, very first show 20 years ago called Stained Glass Ugly at this theater festival of the Manhattan
Manhattan Theater Festival. Yeah.
That was our first thing. And it was, we had put it together. It was the first thing we had done out of grad school.
Which was where? Grad school?
Which was Ohio University.
Right.
Is where we went.
Yep.
And we had produced the show. We thought it was pretty good. And we had zero audience members. Because the one element that we forgot to do was advertise or tell anyone about the show. Because the last show we had done was in grad school, where students just showed up. You know, you do a show, people showed up, and we didn't know we had to actually tell people. And the only reason why Abby showed up was because I rented a rehearsal hall from her. I thought she was cute, and then I bumped into her down the street from where I live, which was complete happenstance. I was like, hey, do you want to see my show? She's like, oh, you do theater? Yeah, I would love to see it. And then she came to see it. And it was her and Reader Martin Denton that were the only people in the theater.
Right.
And she afterwards, she was like, hey, you're actually a really interesting artist. You're a shitty producer. But that's what I'm studying to do at school, so I would love to take it over and figure out a way to get you an audience. And I was like, okay, you know, young, cute girl that I just met. What do you know about theater? And she knew a lot. And the thing that she did was she sat us down and asked us, like, what kind of art we wanted to make with a company called Vampire Cowboys. And I told her all about it, and she was like, oh, you're, like, geeks. I was like, that's not a nice thing to call me. Like, before, that was a term of endearment, you know?
Right.
And she's like, no, but technically that's what you do. There's things you want to do. You're kind of a geek theater company. That's what we'll call you. And I was like, you can't call us a geek theater company because people will confuse it for Greek, and we're not Greek. like people are going to know it's geek, okay? Like, I'm good at what I do. Right. Just shut up and listen to me. And then the next thing that she did was she's like, well, doing what you want to do, you're never going to compete. Like, you know, she gave me this like, weird – because she's like a theater person who likes statistics. And she's like, here's a statistic chart. Mm. Like, you know, if a regular theater person sees 8 shows a year, they tend to be like – you know, a person who has like a subscription and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so they'll have like 6 shows already reserved. And then the half of it, they have one other show per week that they'll, or per month they're willing to see. Are they really going to see you versus something at like Lincoln Center? And like, okay, so that's going to be weird. And her theory was somewhere else. And so there was a startup, which sounds silly now, New York Comic Con that was just Horizon.
I've heard of it. Yeah.
At that time, it was very, very small. It was year one of it. And she was like, what I would like to do is I would like to spend my own money and put a Vampire Cowboys booth there. And that's where we're going to find our fans. I was like, that sounds crazy. Oh, because it was $2,000 to do it.
Right.
So she got a booth there. And that same year, she was like, she looked over and there was this little stage there that was completely empty. And so she just went up to the organizer because it was small. Mm. I was like, hey, what was that stage for? I was like, well, you know, that's for like our speakers and things. We don't have a lot of them because we're very new. She's like, well, that's form on. And they're like, yeah, absolutely. And so she called me up and was like, hey, call up all our actors' friends. We're going to put them in cute, like, Hollywood adventure costumes, choreograph fights. We're just going to get people to look at us. Mm. And so that's what we did. And that kind of drew in our first, like, group of fans who kind of came up and were like, what are you? We're a theater company. They came to see our first show. And geeks, unlike, like, a regular theater, you know, person, I would say, has two things that they do. One, because they come from a cinema culture, the most important time to see a show isn't later in the run. It's to see the very first run. So we ended up selling out previews, or we sold out right away because – geeks see it at top. And then once they realize theater, unlike film, there is no second, you know, that you can't buy it on DVD. The only way to obtain the thing that you want is to see it again and again. So then when they realized that we were a thing, they would come and see that first show, the very first performance, and then buy tickets for every following weekend. Wow. So bring their friends and things like that. So we would sell out literally in a day or two for our entire runs. And we just did that for years and years, and you just collect a lot of fans. They brought more people. We were in bigger theaters. We had longer runs. And you just accumulate, like – and in terms of what I do now in comparison to then, it's still very modest. Like, we have a couple of thousand fans, I would say, but that was enough to sustain a company for – you know, for when we were in New York 15 years without really having to depend on a lot of other money, you know.
Yeah. And you are based in L.A. now. I'm talking to you in L.A.
I'm based.
Yeah. And so, and when did you move there, and what sort of prompted that move, and how did your thinking about Vampire Cowboys and its activities sort of figure into all of that?
Well, I mean, like, I moved out here for kind of the reasons that a lot of people moved out here. It was I have kids, and I wanted to see if maybe TV film was a more natural fit to my writing style.
Did it feel like the rise of kind of geek culture over the years of Vampire Cowboys that we were talking about, that it might seem Hollywood would be a little more receptive to the kind of stuff that you write?
The first time I ever even looked at TV was around, I guess it was like 11 years ago when I first was like, I got interested in the notion of coming out here. And at that time, Scott Pilgrim was out. And I thought, oh, this is a good sign. I write very much like Edgar Wright. That's a very style that I really, really enjoy. But Scott Pilgrim bombed.
It sure did.
At the office. And at that same summer, that movie with Sylvester Stallone and all the old action heroes exploded. And basically, and this is before, you know, streaming, so basically everyone pulled back from doing really high concept shows. And as soon as I got out here, everyone was like, oh, do you have like a low concept idea? And I was like, what's a low concept? I was like, you know, like two stock boys hanging out in the back of a Walmart. And that's like the premise of the show. I was like, I don't write that. And so I immediately ran away from the West Coast because it's like, oh, I don't write that way. I'm not going to ever write you Everyone Loves Raymond or Friends. That's just not how I'm built. I'm funny, but that's not what I'm interested in. And then, of course, like as we all saw what happened to television, it became a different medium. It became a much bigger thing. Serialized stories are now the thing. That's why I think playwrights do so well. We tend to think of character-driven stories, and we love telling stories. Like, given the opportunity for 22 episodes is always fun, or 10 episodes or whatever. And so it became a thing that just fit me. Like, at some point, you know, what Hollywood wanted and what I was interested in just merged naturally. And my manager very much was like, oh, this is your time. This is the moment to come out here and give it a try.
And what do you – you mentioned you're working on another project at the same time as Revenge Song in L.A. Tell us about it.
I can't.
Alas.
I work for the Walt Disney Animation Company. And it's coming out in the future. But – nearish future, and maybe I'll be able to talk about it soon, but not right now.
And you have also worked on the show The Circle at Netflix, yeah?
Society, yeah.
Society, excuse me. Yeah, all right, The Circle being their new show that people are talking about. Totally different. Yeah. And is there a season 2 of Society coming?
Yeah, there's a season two, and that should be out. I think they start filming this spring, and so it should be out maybe summer, fall soon. It's an incredible cast, and the team of writers on it are some of the best writers I've ever gotten to work with. They're incredible team.
What has your work in other genres allowed you to do, in other media allowed you to do, that you haven't been able to do on stage?
Not that I ever listened to artistic directors before, but I think that because I don't, I don't make my money doing theater anymore. It allows me to have the freedom to kind of be really true to who I am as an artist. Like, I don't feel like, oh, if you don't want to do it, my life's over. I'm like, if you don't want to do my show, you don't have to do my show. I'll do it somewhere else. If you want it to be something else, I don't really need to change it because you can just not do it. And so I think it's put me on like an even playing ground where I think before, I think I would have been more open to it, not necessarily because I agreed with that input that I didn't agree with, but because I wanted to keep being paid, you know. And now, because it's not, that element isn't there, it's allowed me to really. And it's not that I'm not collaborative. I'm usually collaborative. But if it's a note I disagree with, I'm not shy to go, yeah, I'm just not going to do that. Or I'll give you the reason why, but I'm not shy about what I think is important to the work that I'm doing, you know?
Right. And what is it, you've sort of answered this tangentially already, but what is it that stage allows you to do that you find yourself unable to do in film and TV?
Oh, well, I mean, like, the stage is still really immediate for me, right? Like, unlike film and TV, what I love about that is the reach that I get. I'm like, oh, just the amount of people who get to see my work through that is satisfying. But it is through the filter of producers and studios and things like that. Whereas theater, it's still me. It's still pure. It's still way closer to what I envisioned. There's immediacy to it. I'm also allowed to be a lot more mischievous. I can swear a lot more. I don't have to worry about, like, if you swear that much, we're suddenly PG-13. Swear that much, we're suddenly R. Like, I don't have to worry about any of those things. I always go, like, the budget in a film to be good is in dollars, right? Like, if I'm doing a big sci-fi movie, a big, you know, superhero flick, it kind of does require $200 million to be made. Otherwise, it just looks cheap, and it doesn't feel good. Whereas, I would say the medium theater is the imagination. So I don't necessarily, like, Vampire Cowboys was doing these big shows on, like, a shoestring budget, you know, and people loved it and had just as much fun, and that's because I was, you know, I was dealing with, like, oh, their brains could fill in the blanks that I didn't, you know, that I couldn't with my money. And so it's fun. Like, I mean, I think at the Geffen we have a little bit more money, but I think we're trying to stick to doing a lot of stage tricks that still require the audience to fill in the blank in a fun way. Just like the new musical SpongeBob SquarePants did a similar trick where it could have come out in like big cartoony costumes. They still used a lot of stage craft and a lot of theatrics, which made it super enjoyable. It surprised me. So.
And do you imagine bringing Revenge Song to New York sometime?
Well, that's the goal. Like, we haven't had a chance to talk to a lot of people yet because of my schedule. But I definitely think that, you know, Abby, being our very good producer, is already in conversations. But I would love to have those conversations. I'm not able to right now.
Yeah. Do you think if you were looking at what the theater industry is sort of like right now, do you feel like it would be harder or easier to start Vampire Cowboys now than it was 20 years ago?
Things are so much more expensive now, to be quite honest. Like, yeah. I think about the spaces available in downtown New York. I think about, like, the rehearsal spaces that, like, the reason I was, it was important to us that, like, when we were in New York, a huge reason why we were able to just be able to develop was the fact that we found really, really cheap but good rehearsal spaces that were big enough to accommodate big fight shows. Because you can't go into a small room if you're going to swing swords around or swing a battle axe around. You need a really big space. And at that time, there was a space called Studio 111. There was this huge space that was only $10 an hour. And then when we took it over as Vampire Cowboys, we kept it $10 an hour because we knew it was very, very important to allow artists to have a place to incubate their ideas in a large, large arena for very little money. I don't know the spaces that exist there. Like, just the times when we would do shows post giving up our studio, it was like, oh, this is the space we have? There's not very much room, and we're paying a lot more money for it. And that you know, that seems like a small problem. It's just a small one. Then we just talk about, you know, theater spaces to rent from. Not that we wouldn't have found a way to do it if we were to have started today, but I think it would have been there is a little bit more complex. The one good and bad too about when we came out, social media was still very new, and so when we were using platforms like MySpace and Facebook and Friendster to advertise our shows, there wasn't a lot of competition for eyeballs. And now, like, social media is such a thing that, like, me posting about my show disappears like instantaneously. It's almost as if I didn't need to, you know, why bother doing it at all? And so it's just like, oh, it's the tricks that we had to get attention, to get eyeballs on it, is different then than that. Blog culture was still a big thing in theater then. People read a lot of blogs. Everyone's in podcasts now. Right. I have no idea how to do that. So we would have found a way. We would have just been a company that started and using the tools of 2020. But, you know, I will say the tools of 2000, 2001 were a lot easier to figure out for my old brain.
And so when a young writer asks you for advice as they're just starting out, what do you tell them? What's the thing that you feel like is really important as you're a young artist starting to make your way?
Yeah, I always say this over and over again anytime I talk to a young writer. Write the thing that you want to see. And when I say that, I don't mean the thing you just want to see because you want a job. I mean the thing that you want to see and you're going to see for at least 80 times in a row. You know, because that's, you're going to be in rehearsal every day. You're going to see it a whole bunch. You want a second production. You're going to see it again. And so you're going to see it a lot. And if you're doing it because it's something you think a theater wants to do, or it feels like the right story to be told at this, never going to be a thing, because you're never going to invest in it the same way as a thing that you actually, as a fan, want to see. You know, if you're making a thing, you're like, oh, there's something in my mind that doesn't exist in any medium, and that's a story I just, you know, like, we're doing like a punk rock 17th century, you know, superhero show about Julie Davigny. It doesn't exist. There's nowhere else that exists this version of this thing. And for me, it was very, very important to see this version of this story. And that's why I would invest, you know, all this time into writing it, to making it. And I think that's important that young artists, because I think they sometimes forget that part. They write what's important to them. Absolutely. They write the story. They spend a lot of time trying to figure out the story that only they can tell, which is very, very crucial. I think that's the heartbeat of telling any good story from anybody. But then they forget about the entertainment value. The one where they're like, oh, am I really going to watch this every night and giggle and have a smile on my face and cry at the points where I need to cry? They sometimes forget that. I think that's the other missing ingredient. That's the ingredient that actually honestly just sells to any medium, because that's the passion that allows you to pitch it. You know?
Yeah. I think that's a great place to wrap up, actually. Thanks, Quee. Thanks for joining me. Nice to talk to you.
That was Quee Gwynn, the co-artistic director and co-founder of Vampire Cowboys Theater Company and the writer of Revenge Song, now playing at the Geffen Playhouse in L.A., in New York, he's got Poor Yellow Rednecks coming to MTC's Off-Broadway space later in the spring. If you like what you're hearing on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, please take a moment to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and you can subscribe there or on Spotify or on the Broadway Podcast Network or anywhere else that finer podcasts are dispensed. If you've got feedback, you can find me on Twitter at @gcoxvariety. Next week, I'm talking to Ruth Negga, the Oscar-nominated actress currently reprising her acclaimed performance as Hamlet at St. Anne's Warehouse in Brooklyn. Until then, see you at the theater.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.